member of the band. James Michener is one of the most popular novelists in America. His epic novels like Hawaii, Chesapeake, and South Pacific are usually very much about the place that they're set in. His new novel is about space. At 3 o'clock, we'll hear an interview that NPR's Noah Adams recorded with Michener for NPR Journal. In the language of classified ads, M is married, S is single, W is white, B is black, GBM is a gay black male. Sherry Foxworth has taken out and responded to dozens of classified ads. Her expertise in back-of-the-magazine communications has led to her new book, which is called Classified Love, A Guide to the Personals. She'll be with us in about 45 minutes. With me now on Fresh Air is singer Cleo Lane and saxophonist and arranger John Dankworth. In 1952, Cleo Lane became the singer with the John Dankworth Big Band. In 1958, they were married. They've continued their musical partnership. Dankworth produces and arranges Cleo Lane's albums and has managed her career. They were both very popular in their native England. In the 70s, they started touring the United States and Canada, where they've developed quite a following. Cleo Lane has sung at Carnegie Hall, the Hollywood Bowl, and did a show called Cleo on Broadway. John Dankworth has written the scores for about 20 films, including The Servant, Darling, Morgan, and Modesty Blaze. They'll be performing at Valley Forge Music Fair. That's tomorrow night at 8. And for any more information, you can call 644-5004. That's tomorrow at 8 at Valley Forge Music Fair. Welcome, both of you, to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
And before we talk, I'd like to play a selection from your latest album, and it's called Cleo Lane and Dudley Moore Smiling Through, and with arrangements by John Dankworth. And I'd like to open with a... You, Cleo Lane, singing I Can't Give You Anything But Love with Dudley Moore at the piano. Uh-huh. Would you just tell us briefly how you got to do this album together before we hear it?
Well, Dudley and I have known each other since the late 50s, and we kept in touch over the years, and eventually we discovered that we had one weekend free where we weren't doing anything but we were in Los Angeles. And we decided that we would get together and do the album in a couple of days. So it's all virtually head arrangements.
Could I just mention...
And John then put on string arrangements in London later.
Could I just mention what Cleo hasn't mentioned yet, that not many people in this country know that Dudley was a music major at Cambridge University and a very fine pianist and organist. And when he left Cambridge University, one of his first jobs was as pianist with my band. And then afterwards, he accompanied Cleo in cabaret for a long while. So he's got great musical credentials that not many people know about. And the other thing is that the bass player on this track that we're going to play is the great Ray Brown.
Great. Well, let's hear it.
That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness. And I guess all the things you've ever dreamed of. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell, baby. Diamond bracelets doesn't sell, baby. Till that lucky day, you know darn well, baby. I can't give you anything but love. see you looking swell, baby. Diamond bracelets, woo-woos, doesn't sound.
Cleo Lane with Dudley Moore at the piano from a new album called Cleo Lane and Dudley Moore Smiling Through on Finesse Records. And Cleo Lane and John Dankworth are in the studio with me, and they'll be performing tonight, tomorrow night, that is, at Valley Forge Music Fair. And welcome again to both of you. How did you first begin to work together?
Well, I had a band that was fairly well known in England in the jazz world, and our vocalist left, and it was a cooperative band. The seven of us all decided in the policy, and we decided we needed a new singer, and we auditioned about 64 of them, and none of them were what we wanted. And then one day another one, a straggler, came along named Cleo Lane. No, named Clementine Campbell. And myself and the pianist auditioned Cleo, and we thought she was just unbelievable because she was a finished artist who'd never done any professional singing at all. So that evening we invited her to the club for the other five guys to hear her, and we all thought exactly the same, so we hired her.
I think they really wanted a cheap singer for the night. They didn't have one, so they said to come along and sing in the club. I sang really with my heart in my mouth. I'd never sung in a jazz club. It was a dungeon just off the Charing Cross Road, if anybody knows where the Charing Cross Road is in London. And I was really very frightened, and I didn't think that I'd got the job. But they asked me then, after I'd sung and the break came, to come around to the office, which was in the local pub in the corner, and to settle the finances. They said that they certainly would like me to sing. And they offered me £6 a week, which was, I would think, about $12. In those days, and I had the nerve to ask for seven, and I got it, and I thought that I was a millionaire-ess.
It was, I guess, about 6 years after you started to work together in the band that you got married. Do married couples who work together in music usually have reputations about whether they're an easy couple to work with or a hard couple to work with?
What do you mean, with each other or with other artists, you mean?
When they interact with others.
I don't know. I don't really know much about other married couples. The whole thought of married couples working together in music or show business rather sickens me. You know, I find myself rather dismayed to be part of one.
Well, he certainly does not like me to sort of acknowledge him as a lover, you know, a sort of my darling husband. This, if ever I do anything, which I never do, but if I if I sort of make some sort of gesture towards him.
A lovey-dovey gesture.
He dislikes it intensely on the stage.
Well, that sort of saccharine approach of, yes, we're a darling couple.
Well, we're not,
off the stage. I hate that because it's not true, in fact. You know, we row and fight off the stage the same as any other couple does from time to time, and we just do our work on the stage, and I think the fact that we know each other's work so well enhances it considerably, and there are moments of tenderness in our work, but it should only be in our work and not by me revealing all 32 teeth at once in order to show how much I adore the little wife, so to speak. I think it's all wrong, and our music should speak to it for itself, which I hope it does.
Do tensions from home or from music ever carry over into the other?
I think it did once, and when we came off the stage, we were so angry with ourselves that we'd allowed it to happen, that I think without actually saying anything or making a pact that we would never do it again, I think both of us in our own minds said that we would never, ever take our angriness on the stage to perform, because it really wasn't. It wasn't a nice performance. It was. Some people, I suppose, can work that way, but I can't, and I know that John can't work that way. So we don't. We have our rows a day before.
We have a very few things in common, actually, which I think is good for a marriage, because you know, we're continually a mystery to each other as to how on earth we function. But one of the things we do have in common when we're working is that we're both, I think, set ourselves very high standards musically, but we never turn our backs on the audience. When we're on a stage, part of our experience is to share something with that audience, and if we're not sharing it properly with them, or leaving them baffled, or leaving them uncomfortable, or trying to show how clever we are at their expense, we feel we're not doing what we want to do. And so somehow or other, I think we've succeeded in our careers, both of us, to steer some sort of course between musical solvency, artistic solvency, if you like, and yet a mutual bond with the people who listen to our music. Which I think is important.
That makes me think that sometimes an audience's relationship to a performer, especially a singer, is an almost sexual one. It's all in the mind. But people really do fantasize and wonder about performers, especially when they're glamorous. What's that like for you, especially since, you're up there and really a family relationship? Yes. Is that happening?
I personally hope that they're not fantasizing over me sexually, but enjoying what's coming out of my mouth. And I think, on the whole, from the people that I meet afterwards, they generally do talk about my singing first. They might say, "Oh, you're lovely," or whatever, and my husband thinks you're the cat's whiskers. And the women don't seem to mind that they're husbands. So there can't be a great sexual thing there. Whatever it is that I exude, it isn't a threat to anybody. They do like the music. There is something which I can't hear myself that appeals to a lot of people who are unhappy, and I make them happy, and they write to me and tell me this, and often I meet them, and I get them through bleak periods in their lives. That I don't understand. I really do not understand how a singer can do that.
Are there singers who do that for you?
No, I mean, they don't. I mean, I like listening to them, but they can't. I mean, if I'm miserable, a singer won't make me unmiserable.
Is that
quite
so?
Honestly. No, I've All never. Right. I mean, I'm generally happy when I put on a happy record or whatever.
But no music can change your mood for you.
I can't say that it does. I mean, it enhances the mood that I'm in, and that's either misery or or happiness.
Does it change your mood?
Oh yeah, very much so, because. Or can do, let's put it that way. But I'm not sure by what process. I think that if music intrigues me enough by doing something beautiful, it may not just alleviate and lift up my soul there and then, but what it does, as far as I'm concerned, is when I hear something beautiful, I admire it first of all, and it gives me the goose pimples or whatever that it does anybody else. Then I immerse myself in thinking how it is done. And when I think of how it is done, I cannot think of any other troubles or problems I've got. And if I discover how it's done, or if I think I know how it's achieved, then I've forgotten everything else in my mind anyway.
Well, that's an intellectual way of going at it.
No, because it's moved first emotionally and then goes into the intellect.
Yes, but then you go into the... Well, I couldn't. I wouldn't do that. I mean, if I'm miserable... the music would either make my misery nice.
Anyway, you enjoy being miserable, don't
oh, yes,
you?
You've I
said
do.
So
yes.
often.
I mean, I like all the emotions that I feel, and I don't like to be jolted out of them.
I sometimes try to lift her out of looking a bit downcast, and she said, "Leave me alone, I'm enjoying this tremendously, and I have to stay away."
Well, can you use moods like that while you're performing? Like draw on whether you're feeling... happy or sad?
No, because generally when I go onto the stage, I am happy. I mean, that everything that has gone on before drops away. I can be sick and it drops away, headache, whatever, pain, misery, whatever, that falls away, and that's happiness for me to sing.
Let's talk about what you do when you're both working on a song together. First of all, do you do that process together? Do you choose the songs as a team?
Quite often. I will hear a song and I will say, well, I'd like to do that at some point or other. And I know that I would have to find a way of doing it for myself. And although John isn't a great pianist, we get to a piano and doodle around, and I'll start singing it. A key, quite often, is very important for me, that although I have a very wide range, and I can sing in many keys, the song has to be in the right key to convey what I want. I mean, it could be right down in my bottom register.
Yeah, and most singers, you can settle a key in 5 or 10 minutes, you know, and quite often have to. Cleo, it could easily take 3 days because she'd decide on one after 2 hours rehearsal and then the next morning change her mind and say, I think it's too high and too low. And it does make a great deal of difference to the way a song is shown or exhibited to an audience, the key, because it can, especially with a great big range like Cleo, it can make a vast difference to the way it's presented. But I always find when I'm dealing with a new song with Cleo, if we both decide that the song is a good one to work on, and that takes a long while because we've got very different ideas about that, then I know that if I've got any preconception about the way that should be arranged, I'm going to almost certainly have to throw them away with Cleo. You know, no sooner have I dreamed out of a beautiful and original type of introduction with oboe, contrabassoon and strings or something, when I will about to divulge that to Cleo, when Cleo will say, I think I should start this completely unaccompanied, that sort of thing. You know, and we start from poles apart and gradually home in on something that we both agree on.
What goes through your mind when you're figuring out an arrangement for a song that you'll be singing?
Well, it used to be, how can I display all the wares and strengths I have as a writer, harmonically and rhythmically and so forth, behind the singer? But you quickly learn with Cleo Lane that there is no other way to arrange a song but to let Cleo Lane have as much possible breadth of interpretation as she can and do the least behind her to upset it. If you can do something that you occasionally hope will inspire her to do something different, then just very occasionally do that. But as for being clever as an arranger behind Cleo, you should forget that approach completely.
What are you going to be thinking about when you sing a song? Do you think about the narrative and try to convey that mood?
I do like, and lyrics do concern me very much. In fact, I'm going back now in time, when John and I got married in 1958, I'd made a decision to leave his band as a band singer and have a solo career. And luckily, I was offered an acting job, a career, and I took it up, and I became extremely interested in words and how they meant and wanted to really convey an acting job when I sang. And this sort of means a great deal to me, that I approach quite a lot of songs in that way, thinking of the story behind it and how I can imagine a little playlet in my head to get the most out of it. John sometimes thinks I go over the top, and I suppose occasionally I do.
Well, I don't mind what you do, so long as you can act as much as you like, so long as you sing as well. But I think on the occasions when you drop singing and do talk a line, that's when I don't like it, because lots of actresses can do that. And very few people can sing like you can, so why?
Well, I think if it can be combined, I enjoy doing both.
I'm sure it can, but sometimes you go over the top, as you say.
Well, that I admit. That's when I feel that I want to act my head off.
Let's listen to another selection from the new album, Cleo Lane and Dudley Moore, Smiling Through. And John Dankworth did the arrangement on the piece that we're going to hear, which is a medley of I Don't Know Why I Love You Like I Do and Love Me or Leave Me. And why don't we talk about the arrangement of this after we hear it?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
but I want you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do. I don't know why you thrill me like you do. I don't know why you just do. You never seem to want my romancing. The only time you hold me is when we're dancing. I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why I just do.
Cleo Lane with Dudley Moore at the piano and an arrangement by John Dankworth. Cleo Lane and John Dankworth are my guests. They'll be performing at the Valley Forge Music Fair tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Well, before we heard that, we were talking about arrangements and figuring out what you're going to do with this song.
Well, to start off, the Love Me or Leave Me bit, Dudley was doodling, singing it and playing it on the piano in the studio. Because most of these arrangements with the rhythm section are head arrangements, and I think he'd sung it somewhere on the a television just prior to this recording date, and I said, "Oh, that would be a nice song to do," and yet we'd got too many songs or so. I said, and it was my idea to just put that little intro of. And I thought that it would work. Why don't we do Love Me or Leave Me and Let Me Be Lonely, and then go into I Don't Know Why, which, and that worked. And then from then on, we just sang the song out and did the thing. Then John, of course, added the string arrangement. And then there's another little bit when I come back in the second chorus. Where I didn't go up High. Where would that be? That
just at the end of the release. In
yeah, fact. Never going up there. Never seemed to want my room. And I didn't do that originally. And John said, I think it would be rather nice if you did. And so later on, after we'd recorded the song, I slipped that bit in, which he thought would work well. So it's a combination, really, of three heads. And even the rhythm section, Ray Brown had sort of put in his spoke as well every now and again, and said, "Oh, let's speed it up in the rhythmical, the instrumental bit." Which, if you notice it, when they start playing, it just edges up in tempo and then drops back.
Clear used the technical term head arrangements. I'm not sure if all listeners know what that means, but it just means that everybody in the band contributes to the unwritten arrangement that is then subsequently worked out, and everybody remembers what they have to do, occasionally jots things down, but there's no one arranger in the first instance. But what you can do with a head arrangement by a rhythm section like that, with just Clear Lane and four players, is to add other instruments afterwards by modern recording techniques. So we decided on four of the, 10 tracks is it on the album, to add some strings, and we did that in London afterwards, so that you hear a simultaneous performance, but in fact the strings were there added some months afterwards, or weeks, I forget what it is. But that, of course, gives the arranger an easy job, because he's already got the structure that works completely well without any strings or without any arranger. But all he can do afterwards is enhance it. In the business, it's called sweetening, presuming that the strings are sweet, and therefore you put on a sweetener when you add them. I tried to avoid doing that on this record, because everything was so perfect that I wasn't really sure why they asked me to put the strings on, except that it made a little variety on some of the tracks. So I put as little string writing on it as I possibly could, and all my ideas were there, because Dudley had already done his harmonisation ad lib and improvised beautiful chords and lovely structures, and all I had to do was really follow that line with the strings.
Do you like the word sweetening?
No. It's just a technical term that you accept now, whatever it means. But
What makes a good string arrangement?
Well, that's difficult. I think it depends on the circumstances. For a symphony orchestra, I think it's terrible to use the most simple common denominator, which so many writers do, and get the string players who are each capable of playing the Mendelssohn concerto or its counterpart in the other instruments, to get them to play whole notes all the time. I think it sounds as if they are bored when this happens. And so I think with string writing in general, that you should try to do something to interest the players, and also to take advantage of the best qualities of the instrument, while not, once again, overdoing it or trying to appear too clever. We do a lot of symphony work. We were with the Philadelphia Orchestra earlier this year at the Mann Auditorium, and I feel that there is a brilliant, perhaps 60 brilliant string players there, and you must take advantage of them as best you can. And usually, thank goodness, the string players do appreciate that, and they get awfully fed up when they're told they're playing with yet another pop artist who really only wants them to do that sort of drone effect, which a synthesizer could do much better. And so when I do write for them, I try to write for 60 virtuosi as opposed to 60 drones.
You were both very popular from the 50s on in England, but it wasn't until the 70s that you came to America and Canada and started touring, and audiences were introduced to your music. What was your strategy when you first set out for this part of the world and began to introduce audiences to you?
Well, I was in a show in London. I was in Showboat, and I was in that for a whole year. But it was in 6 months segments. After the first 6 months, I broke off to do a tour of Australia. And that was the first time that I'd really ever gone that far away from Europe. My whole career had been Britain and the continent. And it was amazingly successful. And as we toured back, it was actually John's idea, and he said, if we can be that successful in Australia, that far away, I don't see why we shouldn't have a crack at America. And that's how it all started, and I pass over the saga to JD.
Well, coming back from Australia, we overflew New York, and we decided, I think we did a talk show in New York, which was the only thing we'd ever done in England, in the States. And I thought I'd go and see a couple of agents there to see if there were any possibility of doing anything. So I went to three classical agents, and they didn't know what I was talking about. They didn't know what a Clio Lane was, and they weren't really too interested in listening. So eventually, after almost total defeat, someone asked me to go, or suggested I went to see a rock promoter named Ron Delsner, who did things at Madison Square Gardens with people like Elton John or Tom Jones, those sort of people. And when I went to explain to him, I spent 20 minutes talking myself hoarse, because I realized that you mustn't be a modest Englishman when you're talking to agents in America. If you got it, flaunt it, they say, I believe. And so I flaunted it for 20 minutes and really shot my mouth off. And at the end, he looked at me and said, "I got it. She's a class act." A class act was what she said. And I said, "Yeah, she's a class act. She's got class." And I knew what that meant. I found out what it meant as I went along. And Ron agreed to put Clio on as a class act on at the Alice Tully Hall in the Lincoln Center, 1,000 seats, right? And so I fixed up our first tour of the United States, which was at the 1,000-seater Alice Tully Hall, and one date in Norman University, Oklahoma. That was our coast-to-coast tour. And we did both. And the one for Norman University was for nothing, by the way. They paid our fares there, but
we didn't get a fee. It was my friend who was a teacher there, Professor
Tom Carey.
Thomas Carey, who had been in Showboat with me.
And we did, and the concert at Alice Tully, we decided to co-promote with Ron Delsner, and we lost $150 on that. So it was not a very lucrative first tour of the States. But after the Alice Tully concert, John Wilson of the New York Times said the British who've been dropping one rock group after another on us have been hiding and hoarding one of their national treasures. And so it went on a rave review. We got rave reviews in Newsweek, in Time, in everything in sight. And that was worth a lot to our plans to get into the concert circuit in America, which we subsequently did. And here we are.
Well, luckily, we went on tour, and our reviews went along with us, and the people came along just to see what the New York reviewers were talking about, and I had to live up to them, and I kept my fingers crossed and hoped that the gods would land on my shoulders and enable me to live up to the reviews, which luckily I was able to.
Are there any dramatic differences between touring England and touring the States?
Americans are much more extrovert in many ways, and they show that they love you, if they do love you, a lot more. The British are reserved and sit on their hands a bit, and you have to work a hell of a lot harder to get them to stand up.
Yes, they'd almost convinced us we weren't any good in England for 20 years. We had to go to Australia, then here, to find out we weren't too bad.
Well, you've really developed quite a following
in
the States and in Canada.
When I did that concert at the Alice Tully Hall, it was like starting right from scratch again, but with know-how, and what every artist dreams about. You know, if only I could start again, knowing what I know today. And that is exactly what happened. I got this, my career in Britain, which was as high as it really possibly could ever go. And here I was starting as a nobody in America, but with all that know-how. And it worked. And so I had that opportunity. It was marvelous.
Yeah, it worked. Thanks so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it.
Terry, it's been a
Thank
pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been with,
I enjoyed it.
Been with Clio Lane and John Dankworth, and they'll be performing tomorrow night at the Valley Forge Music Fair. That will be at 8 o'clock. And if you'd like any more information on that, I have a phone number for you, which is 644-5004. That's 644-5004. And if you want to hear their most recent record, it's called Clio Lane and Dudley Moore, Smiling Through. It's on Finesse Records, with arrangements by John Dankworth, Dudley Moore at the piano, Ray Brown on bass. And let's listen to another selection from this album. We'll hear the Rodgers and Hart tune, It's Easy to Remember. Would you like to say anything about this before we hear it?
I think I picked it because, I mean, it's a silly reason to pick it, but I picked it because my father used to sing it when I was very, very young, and I always loved it.
And I never knew that. I only found it out on this program.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us. And this is Cleo Lane, Dudley Moore, Smiling Through from the album.
Your sweet expression, the smile you gave me, the way you looked when we met, it's easy to remember, but so hard to forget. You whisper, I'll always love you. I know it's over, and yet it's easy to remember, but so hard to forget. So I must dream to have your hand caress me, fingers press me tight. I'd rather dream than have that lonely feeling stealing through the night. Each little moment is clear before me, and though it brings me regret, it's easy to remember and so hard to forget.
That was Cleo Lane with Dudley Moore at the piano from their new album, Smiling Through. And this is Fresh Air. It's 3:15, and you're tuned to 91 FM WUHY in Philadelphia.